The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
Remember that advocacy is all about reverse engineering. You're constantly working backwards. So we start with our closing because we want to persuade the court to accept our application, or perhaps we are asking for the jury to find the defendant guilty. Whatever it is, you'll know what it is that you want. You then work backwards from your closing speech and say, what do I need to get from that witness in order to use that for my closing? And I thought that was very important because it means that I'm not asking questions for the sake of it, and I'm not making submissions that aren't relevant and focused. And it was really helpful in terms of making me a much more efficient advocate.
Hello, listeners. It's Yasmin here. Today, my guest is Bibi Badejo. And Bibi is a barrister from Four Brick Court Chambers, specialising in family law. I really enjoyed speaking with Bibi, and the listener can probably pick up on my passion as I'm speaking with her in this conversation. I found Bibi really open, honest, relatable, warm, engaging, funny, you know, really easy to talk to. And that made it an absolute pleasure to speak about all things about advocacy, communication, public speaking, topics that are really close to my heart. So what are you going to get from this podcast as a listener? Well, Bibi is the founder of the Advocacy Podcast, which I'm a huge fan of. And Bibi was extremely generous in the podcast interview with sharing her tips and advice on how to improve your advocacy skills, whatever stage you are in your career, whether you're a barrister or not. Extremely generous. And also, you know, the podcast mentions that good advocates are not born. And Bibi's very honest about, actually, she felt really nervous when she started her advocacy journey. And it's something you can perfect and get better at and push through, really feeling uncomfortable. So sit back and enjoy this episode as much as I enjoyed making it.
The Hearing.
And welcome to the podcast, Bibi Badejo. I'm a great fan of yours. I've tuned into the Advocacy Podcast, which we'll get into later. Love for you to share all about that later in the podcast. But firstly, welcome to the Hearing Podcast.
Thank you so much, Yasmin. I'm so happy to be here.
Brilliant. Well, let's get stuck into it. So first question I have for you, Bibi, is what inspired you to pursue a career in law? Because you're a barrister. Tell us a little bit about what you do and what inspired you to follow that path.
Right. So I'll start off first with what I do. I'm a family law barrister at Four Brick Court in London, and I've been doing that for about 15 years now. And I really wish I had the most inspiring story about how I became a barrister and why I got into it. But it really isn't. And I say this because for as long as I can remember, I've always wanted to be a lawyer. And I think I trace that back to watching LA Law and programs like that. And I also remember disappointing my mother thoroughly when I told her at 8 years old that I didn't want to be a doctor. I wanted to be a lawyer. And she said, oh, being a doctor is so much better. And so that's what's driven me. And I suppose watching movies and films, I really liked the aspect of being in the courtroom. So there was no real critical analysis about it. It was just something that I've always known that I wanted to do. And I've ended up doing my dream job. The journey was quite interesting as well, because do you know what? I hated public speaking. So wanting to be a barrister in doing the public speaking and addressing judges and juries seemed to be really at odds with what I wanted to do. But hey, I'm here.
Yeah. I don't know many parents who'd be disappointed if their children say, I want to be a lawyer. So that's an interesting one. So there weren't any people in your life, you know, family members or friends or anybody. It was purely watching the films and that really influenced you, did it?
Absolutely. I didn't know anybody, actually, that was anyone that I was close to that was a lawyer. My mum is a primary school teacher. My father was a graphic designer. We had accountants in the family. But no one was actually there for me to see what the day in, day out job was. And I think if I'd seen how hard they'd worked, perhaps I might not have gone into it as faithfully as I did.
Yeah. And so tell us about your early experiences, BB, in the legal field. What were some of those challenges? Have you faced any challenges getting into this profession and progressing?
There definitely were challenges. So as you can imagine, I'm sure it's the same for training contracts when you want to become a solicitor. Like, pupillage was incredibly hard. I remember applying for pupillage and it took me about 3 years to finally get there. And that would be one of the lowest points in my life for me, because that's all I wanted to do. And every year there was getting that knockback. And during that period, I would work as an advocate for an agency that worked with solicitors. So we'd go to court, which was great in terms of getting advocacy experience, because I didn't think I was very, very good. But there was a level of imposter syndrome, I guess, because there were those challenges. And I can give you a couple of examples. So when I was an advocate, I went to court and I was speaking to my opponent, who was counsel, and I was speaking to him and he walked away. He just turned around and he walked away in the middle of my sentence. And I just thought, oh my gosh, what I've got is not worth listening to. And it was really quite demoralizing. It floored me. My mouth was just open. And I thought, wow, I'm not supposed to be here, but, you know, got over that. I was fortunate enough to get pupillage. And again, there were a few knockbacks. And there was one occasion, I think it was my very first week of my second six, so I'm on my feet. And the judge was just shouting at me. And I just thought, oh my God, is this what it's going to be like? So with that in mind, I just tried to work harder and do the best that I could, really. So those were my challenges. But I really felt that imposter syndrome, in the sense that, one, I shouldn't be here, and two, someone's going to find out about me. Gosh. I think they're common feelings that people have. And I suppose there was another one, a third aspect to the imposter syndrome, which was I didn't feel like I was as good as I could be. I guess there were things in my head and I just didn't know how to get it out during cross-examination or doing my speeches. So I did find it quite difficult and challenging. And I suppose one of the difficulties is that you can't really talk to anybody about it. Who am I supposed to talk to and say, do you know what? I don't think I'm that good. As a barrister, you're supposed to be. People are relying on you. The stakes are high. So it was quite an isolating experience in the beginning.
Mm. I'm just shocked that that person walked away from me. I mean, how rude is that?
I know.
What's going on there? But yeah, I can imagine when you're starting out, you do question your ability and should you be there, and particularly someone senior to you doing that, it makes you question everything and you internalize that feeling of a lack of worth and questioning your ability. So I completely understand that. So let's get into the advocacy podcast, actually. It's interesting you had this fear of public speaking, and yet you've pursued being a barrister and you've now founded the Advocacy Podcast in 2021, I believe.
That's right.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about that? Was it for the purpose of helping people like you who started out in the beginning to really hone their skills and get better at this? Is that part of the reason?
That's exactly it, Yasmin. So it's a bit of a long story, if you don't mind me just going from the beginning of that. Because
we've got time.
Oh, great. Fantastic. my fear of public speaking really didn't go away. And I have to say, it really was a fear. And there've been two occasions, one when I was at university and the other where I was in an advocacy training doing my pupillage. I don't think I've shared this publicly before, so here goes. But I would start speaking really quickly because I wanted it to be all over. But when I did that, I would stop breathing. I wouldn't breathe. And I actually fainted on one occasion, which freaked out the trainers because they thought, oh my goodness, what's just happened here? But it just frightened me so much that I just couldn't function in the way that I usually would. And I fainted and I just thought, oh my God, again, I'm not good at this. And then there was another occasion years later where I didn't get the result that I wanted for my client. And I just found that so, so upsetting. I was upset for her. I was upset for myself as well. And I just thought that's never going to happen again. It wasn't to the extent that I thought I was completely rubbish. We win cases, we lose cases. Sometimes there's nothing that you can do about it. And sometimes you win in spite of yourself. You're successful in court. So I knew I wasn't absolutely awful, but I just thought that I could do with some help. So I made the decision to go on the Keeble Advanced Advocacy course. And that was, it changed my career. I have to say, it changed everything. And what that is a week-long residential course, which is held in Keeble College in Oxford, run by the Southeastern Circuit. And I promise you, it's career changing, but I will also say I found it brutal and I found it kind of traumatizing. And the reason for that is this: we get up, prepare, close and deliver closing speeches, cross-examination, examination in chief, and then you get feedback. And it feels like you're constantly being criticized to an extent. But what the amazing thing is that you're getting bespoke feedback. So every time, you know, you do something wrong, you just get a really helpful bit of information on how to improve it. And it's really practical. And the following week, when I went to court, and it was quite a serious case, my client had been accused of sexual assault. And I put into practice what I had been taught on that course. And the judge was quoting from my cross-examination. That was in his judgment. And I'd never had that before. And I just thought, oh my God, I can do this. And that kind of set me off on this journey to delve into advocacy more. And I went to Florida to do some training there, a residential course in civil. Then the following year, I went for crime. I went to Australia to do the advanced course there. And then I also did like a specialist cross-examination workshop. And I was just getting all of this information. I was improving exponentially. It was amazing. And where the podcast came from was I just thought, wow, I didn't have any children at that time and I could fly around. It was great. And I just thought, there are people that can't do this. They have commitments or they have money, financial issues, or perhaps children, whatever it is, but they can't always do this and actually experience what I've experienced. And I thought that, do you know what? I'm going to interview these amazing people who have trained me. They can share the information and I can share that. I'm going to write a book. And I was so excited. I told my partner, who rolled his eyes and said, oh my God, B, you're so boring. Just do a podcast. And that's how the podcast was born. So it was really about sharing the sort of information that I knew and that had really changed the way that I approached advocacy, but also trying to put people on a level playing field, I guess, and also aiming it at practitioners who may not feel that they need to do training. They might not feel that, but they can listen to it and get something that's helpful. So that's the aim of the advocacy podcast. And I've been really fortunate that people have listened to it and enjoyed the various episodes.
Well, I'm binging on it at the moment because although I'm not a barrister, we were speaking a little bit before, I think it's great for people who just want to improve their communication, who do some sort of public speaking in their role. Most people do some element of public speaking, you know, speaking in a meeting, speaking in front of other people, clients, for example. And I love what you say on the podcast, that good advocates are not born. You're never too experienced to continue actively developing and perfecting your advocacy skills. So it's not just for people who are at the beginning of their advocacy journey. It's you can always continue to improve, can't you, on your advocacy skills and learn things from different people and the techniques they use. That's what I love about the podcast. It's really for everybody. So yeah, a bit of a fan there. So we could definitely put that hopefully in the show notes so that people can tune into that. And doesn't your podcast feature on the British Airways?
It does.
Playlist. Yeah, I saw that from your LinkedIn. I was very impressed by that.
Yes. Again, very, very lucky. That was down to my partner putting it forward when he was asked by British Airways, do you have any podcasts that you think might be interesting? And he put that forward. And I've been so lucky because it was meant to go on an 18-month run and it's been on there for quite some time. And it's great. I get messages from people saying, hey, I was on my flight to New York or Canada and I saw your podcast and I had a listen. So it's really humbling to know it's just reaching different areas of the world and accompanying people on their journeys. So
yeah, it's really exciting.
Right.
So you've specialised in family law, and what drew you to that particular area? Why family law?
I initially started thinking I was going to go into housing, but then I started volunteering for the National Centre for Domestic Violence, and I just loved being able to make a difference in a really tangible way. I found that family fit me and fit my personality. I guess I love the human element of it. So when I got a pupillage in a family set, it was absolutely perfect. And my specialty is children law. I do mainly public law proceedings, so that's care proceedings. And I do a bit of private law proceedings, that's between parents. But I guess it's being able to help people with the most important thing to them. When you have children, they're your heart. And, you know, the court can make such draconian orders, or the court can bring families together. And the work that I do can influence that. And I really enjoy it. It's also quite challenging. So it's very rewarding in terms of an intellectual aspect as well. So that's why I do family law.
Yeah, I did some family law, and it's very emotional, isn't it, dealing with children. So you, so that I understand this, you act for guardians or parents, or who is it that you act for? Or it could be all sorts of different clients.
All of them, the entire range. So I can act for local authorities, parents, family members, and also guardians, even the children themselves if they're separately represented as well. And I love that I'm able to do that, because I think it helps you to see things from different angles, which helps you become a more rounded advocate, I think.
Yeah, definitely. So what I found difficult, I'd be really interested to hear your view, Bibi, is how you switch off, really, because some of these issues that you talk about in court and dealing with messy human emotions and devastating consequences sometimes if things don't go your way, how do you deal with that on a personal level?
That's such a good question. I think that's something that at the family bar we're still searching. I know the Family Law Bar Association is looking into how we can deal with things like the vicarious trauma. We really deal with such harrowing things. And the way that I found that I dealt with it was, firstly, by not dealing with it at all. We tend to have things that are quite last minute. So I might finish court, get my papers at 5 o'clock to go into court the next day. So it doesn't give you a lot of time to process things, and then you just move on forward. There's also a sense of having to distance yourself from the facts, because you need to start analysing. And so you're not going to think of, you know the child, but I tend not to meet them. So it's not necessarily this child that I know. It's a name on paper, and I know there might be pictures, I might know some facts about them, but I'm able to put some distance between myself and the actual actors, I guess, within the case. So there's an element of that. But for me, I think I'm surprised at what affects me sometimes. I find the separation of siblings really difficult. That really bothers me, and I find that quite hard. I find parents losing their children quite difficult as well. And so it's only now that I've been able to reach out to my coach, one of my coaches, and I'll speak to her about it. And we'll go through that, and then I can perhaps deal with it, and then maybe not always move on, but at least address it and deal with it, because it can be really quite difficult.
And would you say that's essential if you're dealing with harrowing cases, really emotional cases, that as an advocate, you have a mentor or a coach or maybe a colleague that you could share those experiences with to offload and just to be able to sort of deal with those emotions? Is that something you've always had and you'd recommend to others?
So I haven't always had it, but I've had it more recently. And I would absolutely recommend that you are able to offload and just speak about that with somebody, because you don't even realize how much it impacts on you. You know, the pictures that we see and so on, it really has an effect. So just being able to talk to someone, it doesn't necessarily have to be a professional. Or if you do need a professional, perhaps seeking that out through the Bar Council, whatever association it is, chambers, it's really important, really, really, really very important.
Yeah. We spoke to a lawyer a while ago about surrogacy. She deals with a lot of surrogacy issues, again, dealing with a lot of emotions. And she spoke to her team regularly and they had check-ins to make sure they were okay. Because the work that they do is you know, it's a lot to deal with that mental toll that it takes. Absolutely. And so in respect of family law, has your perspective on it evolved over time? Have you, you've been practicing in it for a number of years now. What's changed? What's evolved?
I think the biggest thing that changed for me was becoming a parent myself. I think that made a difference, especially since I do a lot of care proceedings. And it was strange because I thought I would go in one way or another. But actually, it's made me a lot more empathetic. So with parents, I can empathize and think, okay, I understand why you did that. I understand where you were coming from and what you were feeling like. But also from the child's point of view, I can think, well, what you needed was pretty straightforward and you didn't get that. And I can empathize. So I think that that's changed for me personally. Professionally, I guess it's the way that the courts are dealing with domestic violence at present. It's been taken a lot more seriously. I say domestic violence, I also extend that to domestic abuse, which is a lot more difficult to identify, you know, coercive, controlling behavior and so on. And the fact that victims of domestic violence are no longer going to be questioned by their abuser or the alleged abuser is hugely important, because that in a way can be another form of abuse. It can be really awful for them. So I think that's been a wonderful change. And especially from the days when I was starting back in 2005, volunteering for the National Centre for Domestic Violence, it's been a really welcome, very welcome change.
Yeah. And even the term coercive control is a relatively new legal term, isn't it, in terms of what it is and recognising that. What would you say to the layperson coercive control is?
I would say coercive control is where you have somebody who is in effect telling you things and preventing you from doing things. So not physically, not necessarily hitting you, but possibly monitoring your phone calls or your messages, telling you that you can't speak to certain people, or even thinking, let's think about finances, monitoring money, ensuring that your money is paid into their account, things like that. Those are examples of coercive control, which if you take the individual action separately, it might not look so bad, but together, it's a pattern of behavior that's designed to prevent someone and to control somebody in a particular way, which is harmful for them.
The hearing. On the outside, you're a lawyer, calm and cool, but inside there's a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. You prepare hour after hour, day after day in the pursuit of excellence, relying on superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence. That's the advantage we give you. Be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
From the war in Gaza.
There are a huge network of tunnels underneath. It looks like a spider web.
To the front lines in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News Podcast is there. We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vinnell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Thinking about your legal career today, are there any cases or legal matters that have really, you think, significantly shape your career, that have really stuck in your mind? Putting you on the spot here.
Yeah, you are. No, but that's fine. I tend to think it's when I'm up against silks sometimes, and that can be incredibly difficult. Why am I saying that could be incredibly difficult? No, it is really difficult. They're so smart. They're so accomplished. You know, they've got that kite mark of King's Counsel. And I remember just as the lockdown started, and I was quite heavily pregnant, and I was up against two silks who are phenomenal. I was for the local authority. and just having to believe in myself and pay attention to any of the everything that they were saying, ignoring what I will call the mind games that they were playing as well, because there's a psychological warfare going on that I wasn't ready for. And preparing, and I think for me, it was about my case analysis that changed when I started doing those sorts of cases where I had to put myself in my opponent's shoes and go 10 steps further. And it was so much work, but investing, it was like an investment. Investing in that time and that work meant that I was able to anticipate a lot of what they were saying against me. So when they raised various arguments, I had an answer. Or when they complained to the judge about something, I also was able to address that pretty quickly without worrying about it. So having opponents who are very experienced and brilliant meant that I had to step my game up, and that was wonderful. So that was an example there. And another one that I can give is, again, acting for the local authority and really putting myself in the shoes of each of the players in the case. And again, we were against Silk. And it was amazing because I wrote the closing submissions, the written submissions. And when the judge delivered her judgment, I could see so much of that in there. And I thought, wow, that felt great. That was a lot of hard work. I want to do it again. So those were changes that I could make. And I wish I could give you details, but I guess it'll make the people identifiable. So I can't really, unfortunately.
Yes, I understand. Yeah. And so what I'm hearing is, does that imposter syndrome never go away? You know, you said the fact that you knew they were Silks and extremely experienced, does that make it a more intimidating situation where you're still questioning your own ability? And
yeah. Do you know what's really interesting? I think I gave you, there was a third aspect for imposter syndrome for me, which was I didn't have the skill set that meant that I should be here. And so through my advocacy training, that's what I've really worked on. So now I feel quite confident and I feel like I belong there. But now it's more about nervousness as opposed to fear. I'm always nervous when I get up and I have to do a cross-examination. And I'm still nervous when I deliver closing submissions. But now I channel that as, okay, you're nervous. That's great. It means that you're paying attention. Let's go. I can say that to myself now. And that's the self-speak, as opposed to, you've prepared this wrong. You're going to mess this up. You're not supposed to be here. They're going to find you out. So just working on my skills meant that I now believe that I'm supposed to be here. So that's been the difference.
That internal dialogue is so important, isn't it? Because I understand that fear, you know, not fear, but nervousness, because it means so much and you've worked so hard towards something. But it's how you channel that into, okay, I'm going to use this to propel me into really doing a good job and using that nervous energy into something good rather than I'm rubbish, they're so much better than me. It can really change the way you talk to yourself and therefore your performance. So yeah, that's a good tip. We'll get into tips later for other advocates or other people who want to communicate in a better way or to channel that nervousness in a second. So other question for you, BB. It sounds like you do a lot. You've got the advocacy podcast, you're a practicing barrister, you're a mother. How do you manage that work-life balance? How do you fit this all in?
Okay. So other thing that I would add in there as well is that I also do advocacy coaching.
Yes.
So I have so many spinning plates, and how I do it is by working with other people. And I'll just describe three distinct groups. I think the first will be my family. I have a very supportive partner and my parents are hugely helpful. So together we're able to work with my son and, you know, drop-offs, pickups, etc. I also work well with teams. So around the podcast, I have a really great team. Around advocacy coaching, I have a fantastic team that I can rely on as well. So they pick up a lot of the slack. And then the third group are my coaches. And one of them, we just work on time management. And it's fantastic. So she helps me when I say that I'm going to do something, she helps me plan. So I do what I say I'm going to do when I say I'm going to do it. Because there's so many plates spinning that I will inevitably drop them. And that's not to say that I don't. I definitely do, but I get a lot more done and I plan in quarters and work every week. We're constantly speaking. So I rely on being coached and getting feedback and having someone else say, "Bibi, is that realistic? Like, really? Are you sure about that deadline? Do we need to shift something? Who do you need to have a conversation with?" And that's the only way that I found that I can do it. Otherwise, I promise you, I'd be rocking back and forth in a darkened room somewhere.
Yeah, I can relate to a lot of this. Lots going on. Yeah. So you've got coaches and mentors. Is there a consistent person who's been in your life that you lean on for advice or mentoring?
I think I'm more of a believer of having tribes. So I don't have one mentor. I have about four mentors that I know that I can go to if I need any help, but also for specific things, which I found super helpful. And they come from all walks of life and they're able to just guide me. So I have a tribe. There isn't that one person, but a few people that I can shout out, even Barbara Mills KC, who is the vice chair of the Bar Council, has been a wonderful mentor to me. It's really inspiring seeing how a Black woman, you know, she's just forging ahead. And that's been hugely inspiring. And she gives such measured advice. She's wonderful. And then there's Sarah Clark KC, who she was the one that gave me faith in myself about becoming a barrister. And she, you know, I bombed in one of the Keeble advocacy exercises. And I was thinking, my God, this is hugely embarrassing. I cannot show my face again. But she said, no, you just need to tweak a few things. You could be devastating in court. Why don't you train to become an advocacy trainer? And she set that emotion. And she, I don't think she believes me, but she changed my life in that way because she had that faith in me. And another person that I would speak about is Roger Dodd, who is king of cross-examination, and he's taken me under his wing and taught me so many techniques. And if I have a question, I know that I can rely on him as well. And there are a few other people that I won't mention, but just having those people who I know have my back has been hugely helpful. And they're separate from coaches that I pay to help me become better. I think the way that I can describe it as well is Ian Robinson SC. He's an Australian silk and amazing again. And he said, well, you have elite athletes who are the best at what they do. For example, Roger Federer. And he has a coach. He has a coach because he's the best, but he wants to get better. And I thought, well, wow, aren't we intellectual athletes, I guess? And I want to improve. So I have a team of people who helped me reach my potential.
Yeah, if it's good enough for Roger Federer, there's no shame in having a coach at all. Absolutely. So tell us a bit about the advocacy coach. We talked about the podcast. That was founded in 2021 as well. How does that work then?
Okay. So what I thought was you have the podcast, which is a free resource for people. But I also thought that there were techniques that could better be delivered in a, you know, a more of a closed setting. So I don't know what I was thinking. I think I was on maternity leave and clearly had so much time on my hands to launch a podcast in January and then a separate business in October. But what my thinking was working with people who generally are established practitioners. And I work with people, you know, who are new practitioners, so 3 years plus, all the way up to beyond 20 years training, because I just thought that there was a gap. These amazing courses like Keeble and the other residential courses that I've gone to, they only run once a year. And if you want to improve, I didn't see that there were huge amounts out there. So I thought that that was something that I could offer. So I devised an advocacy program, 12 sessions, huge focus on cross-examination. I teach you frameworks. It's very technique-led, as well as me giving feedback. So that's something that I do, like one-to-one group coaching and for firms. But I also thought that there was a way that I can offer a range. So, for example, I also do the Advocacy Clinic, which is a monthly free resource for people to practice. I have actors. You can cross-examine them or chief, you know, do evidence in chief, and I will give you feedback so that you can improve. And that's free. And I also have like online courses so people can buy those and work at their own pace. So I just wanted to provide a variety of different resources that people could tap into and learn from what I have learned. I'm not this brain box. I do a lot of reading. I do a lot of training, but I'm standing on the shoulders of giants and I'm just sharing that information basically. So that's how it's come about.
Yeah. And it's something you wish would have been in existence perhaps when you were starting on your advocacy journey, to get a little bit more confidence and hone those skills. And is it open to everybody, not just barristers?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So wannabe barristers who fancy themselves wanting Absolutely. To do this job. Yeah. Any stage.
Yeah, totally. Any stage. So I also work with Bridging the Bar. I'm not sure if you've heard
I
of
have,
them.
Actually.
They're an incredible charity. Yes. That work with underrepresented people and underrepresented groups. And they take them from, you know, maybe law degree, bar school, through their journey of applying for pupillage. And they even get to intern at the Supreme Court, which is incredible. And I do their advocacy training. So I work with like the babies, so the students all the way up, the clinics, for example, anyone can join in. Anyone can do it, which has been great. So everyone learns from each other.
Yeah, fantastic. And lastly, what practical tips can you share for those on the advocacy journey? You've shared so much, so many important things already, but what other tips do you have for people?
Okay, so I was thinking about this and I thought that I would share five things that really made a difference for me. And the first is to remember that advocacy is all about reverse engineering. You're constantly working backwards. So we start with our closing because we want to persuade the court to accept our application and so that we can succeed, or perhaps we are asking for the jury to find the defendant guilty. Whatever it is, you'll know what it is that you want. You work backwards. What do I need to say in order to get there? So you do your closing. And then what you can do is with your witness handling, so that's your examination chief and cross-examination, you then work backwards from your closing speech and say, what do I need to get from that witness in order to use that for my closing? So you're literally like unfolding and working backwards. And I thought that was very important because it means that I don't waste questions. I'm not asking questions for the sake of it, and I'm not making submissions that aren't relevant and focused. And it was really helpful in terms of making me a much more efficient advocate. The second thing which blew my mind was that you need to practice your advocacy. I think it's crazy that we just prepare our submissions and then stand up and say them, and you've never heard what it sounds like. And, you know, we're working with really high stakes. People's liberty, money, families are at stake here. And you have to practice, because what happens when you practice, and I would say, you know, go through it 2-3 times, say it out loud, is you hear what it sounds like. Sometimes you might want to change something because, do you know what? It's a tongue twister. I can't say that effectively. Or maybe I want to break it down. Perhaps it doesn't flow. And you can be a lot more conversational, because the more familiar you are with your content, the more that you can just speak with your tribunal, and it becomes so much more effective. So make sure you practice your advocacy. And the third thing that I was thinking about, and it's all about thinking, is spend a lot more time than you think thinking about your case. Really invest in time turning it over, thinking about your case analysis. And I think about, if I were on the other side, what would I do? Because I think my opponent is as good as me or better. I never think that they're any worse than me. They're always my standard or better. I think, you know, we're literally competing against ourselves in that respect. And I try and think about what I would do. And then once I have an understanding of that, I then think, okay, how am I going to protect myself from that? Or how will I deal with that? And it means that it's really effective, because you can then shape your argument so that they're a lot more effective in that way. And I would also suggest that you think about your own weaknesses, the bad points, because sometimes what we're putting forward doesn't quite make sense. So talk about it with other people. So does this make sense? This is what I'm thinking. What do you think? And getting that feedback, because more often than not, you'll have a friend or perhaps a parent who will say, but what about this? And you think, wow, I never thought about it. And just doing that thinking just means that, again, you're more focused and it's an investment, which makes it so much easier for you. I'm a firm believer in not making things too difficult for yourself. The fourth thing that I wanted to share is, oh, this is an interesting one. A dictionary and thesaurus are 100% part of your toolkit. And I say this because sometimes we have words that we want to use, but they're not quite right. Having that complete understanding about what the words you're using mean, in particular adjectives and adverbs, strong verbs. Sometimes a witness might not accept a word that you've used, but if you've thought about the different options for that word, maybe it's not as strong, but it means the same thing. For example, if I want to say, you know, Yasmin, you charged down the road, didn't you? No, I didn't charge down the road. If I said you walked down the road, that might be okay. If I said you walked quickly down the road, you were angry, then we get the impression that you were charging, perhaps. And then perhaps I can use it. So being able to define words and also look at them, explore the different types of words. So we have a spectrum that roughly mean the same thing, means that you can easily maneuver the witness to agree with a lot of your propositions, which, you know what witnesses can be like, is not always easy, but that was a game changer for me. And the final thing is be flexible and curious. And I say be flexible, and it links kind of to my point, is that you have a toolkit, and the tips that you learn, you can put in your toolkit and you can use them whenever it's needed. I'm not always going to be the same with every single witness. I'm going to change accordingly, depending on what I think will be the most effective way. My tribunal is going to change, so I might need to change there. My opponent, my client, these are all things that might influence the way that I think that I can get the most out of a witness or the way that I can be the most persuasive. So being flexible is key. And in order to become flexible, be curious about advocacy. You know, of course, I'll plug my podcast. Listen to my podcast, get some tips, come to the clinic. That's fine. But you don't have to do that. There are TED Talks that you can watch and think, oh, wow, I love the way that she started off. I love the way that he spoke or the way he used pauses. You can go outside of just advocacy books. You can look all around you and see how people have been persuasive. And I know that when I was looking at your TED Talk, Yasmin, I thought, I love the way that she started. How will I incorporate that into one of my speeches? Because you started with a question. I thought that was really effective. It got me. No, hey, people need to listen to this. But these are the sorts of things that I got so much from. And these are resources that are around us and they're free. So be curious, learn, and then you can use what you've learned really flexible. That's not even a word. Flexibly is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Some brilliant, brilliant tips there. And I would add not some further tips, but sort of elaborate on what you've said is that definitely looking at TED Talks and other ways that people communicate, stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
For me, that was a game changer in that humor, people tend to like people who are funny. And, you know, obviously you have to be appropriately humorous because sometimes in a very serious case, you can't go there. But there sometimes are places for light relief. And if an advocate is able to learn the skills of comedy, you know, there's certain rules that you can follow. That is really useful as well. The skill, the art of comedy is really interesting to master, and how you do that. In front of a jury or in front of a judge. I mean, obviously, got to be careful with the judge, but you've got to really, that's a skill in itself. That's been useful in terms of how I do my public speaking, communicate as well. And I love there was a particular episode you did on the podcast about, you know, saying, speaking out loud before you, you know, go into court or do that presentation, because using different voices or being louder or softer, really playing with it, that's helped me enormously. Because you're right, sometimes you say something out loud that that doesn't sound right at all, or it's a tongue twister. So really practicing that, there's some great skills there. BB, I could talk to you for a very long time. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I hope people check out your podcast and your coaching service. You're doing some really interesting work. And I thank you so much for being a really interesting guest on the Hearing Podcast. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful talking to you.
The Hearing.
So as ever, listeners, we'd like you to like and subscribe, and also your feedback is very welcome.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.